agenda for today is essentially, first, we are trying to listen to what Russian women think and experience on a number of issues. The first thing is going to be on trafficking, and we're going to talk about the policy implications of the findings. We're going to talk briefly about their views on prostitution. Then we're going to turn to experiences of harassment and discrimination in the workplace. In the survey, we also look at experiences of discrimination and harassment in educational institutions, but we're going to save that for another day. We have some interesting findings on how women view various professions, and that sheds light on how they think about gender and gender roles. And we have findings on, we looked at why Russian women aren't having more children. We're not going to talk about that today, except if you want to in Q&A. We think that the financial crisis is probably going to have some relevance on the larger demographic crisis, and our findings are relevant for that. This survey is really trying to fill a number of gaps in our knowledge. There are a lot of conventional wisdoms, I'd say there are even myths driving views on a lot of these issues, which, you know, absent data, that's often common. We have had, at best, an anecdotal sense of how widespread particular views are and experiences are. What we're presenting today is benchmark survey data. You know, if we were able to resurvey over a couple of years, we'll have a better sense of, I think, social facts. So I want to caution you that, you know, these data are our benchmark. But if we are able to amass a body of data, it's going to enable us to design more effective policy interventions. So the survey began with four focus groups in April 2007 in St. Petersburg. And we were able to do this with some graduate students from the European University in St. Petersburg's Gender Studies program. And we had colleagues from the Levada Analytics Center in Moscow conducted the focus groups. We wrote the focus group script and then observed the focus groups. In the summer of 2007, the graduate students at European University did follow-up in-depth interviews with a number of women who participated in the focus group. So there was a lot of qualitative research that went into writing this survey instrument. The survey itself was pre-tested on 20 women, and then it was fielded in March and April of 2008, and they eventually ended up surveying 2,004 women between the ages of 16 and 34. We are very grateful to the Ford Foundation for supporting this survey. I will tell you, it took about 4 or 5 years to get funding for the survey. Many presentations at various places saying we need to hear the voices of women on this issue, and we're grateful that Ford was also interested in hearing from these women. I want to just caution and say that the survey addresses obviously multiple and separate issues. By presenting the work on trafficking and then presenting the work on prostitution, we don't need to be conflating them. And also that the response categories that you'll see presented, many of them come from the focus groups. They're not necessarily ways that we would have phrased them. They're ways in which the Russian women in the survey, in the focus groups, were talking about them. Here is a table that shows you the basic sample characteristics. I'll only just say, since we have a lot of information to go through, that this is a nationally representative sample. The Levada Analytics Center is particularly good because they use standard scientific sampling methods. Is there anything else to add on at this point? I don't think I need to tell this audience what is involved in human trafficking, but since we're hoping to podcast this, I will say that we've been using the definition from the UN protocol. We're looking at forced prostitution in this case, involving being sold as chattel, stripped of passport, and forced to pay off bogus debt to their traffickers. The way in which we phrase trafficking, you'll see in a minute. The policy context of this is, of course, that Russia has appeared on the Tier 2 watch list for 5 years. The State Department's report, I think that's as long as they've had a Tier 2 watch list. Russia is viewed as a major source country, destination, and transit country. And according to the State Department's 2008 trafficking report, there's little to no funding for victims assistance programs. This morning on NPR, Andy Garrels did a story drawing a card on our survey data, but more importantly, on a trip that she recently made to Chelyabinsk, where she was interviewing some shelter directors and victims. And this lack of victims assistance programs is really striking. And we'll return to that in a minute, because I think there's some cultural barriers in the way that we need to address. There is, to the best of our knowledge, no government funding from the Russian government to NGOs working on anti-trafficking programs. And there's been no, while trafficking has been criminalized in Russia, there is no comprehensive legislation that's been passed. It's been pending since 2003. So the range of conventionalisms, again, absent survey data, are that Russian women have never heard of the phenomenon of human trafficking. They don't really know what it is. That was one hypothesis out there. Russian women are easily duped into trafficking through advertisements for work abroad. Another conventionalism is that it's actually a donor-driven concern, or especially in the environment of Russia today, that this is mostly the concern of foreigners. Or on the flip side, that it's not at all rare. In fact, that trafficking involves upwards of 10,000 women sold a year from Russia. So this first figure asked the question of, have you seen an advertisement for highly paid work abroad, no experience necessary? And you will see in the results are that overall 64% of the survey respondents had in fact seen it.
Yeah, let me just jump in at this point and say that, so in designing the survey, you know, we face a real challenge, and we spend a lot of time discussing, okay, how are we going to see if women are really aware of this issue without asking them directly, have you heard of trafficking, at the very outset? Or, you know, it's a very difficult prospect trying to use a survey instrument to actually find out, you know, are women actually aware of this problem? Are they suspicious of such ads? How would they interpret ads like this? So the approach that we came up with is to first just say, have you ever seen an ad like this? And we actually took the wording for a real ad, which said, you know, looking for women who are interested in working in the entertainment industry in
Las Vegas,
€6,000 a month, no experience necessary. So indeed, an ad that did sound too good to be true. And so our approach was to first ask them, you know, have you ever seen an ad of this nature? Would you consider responding to an ad of this nature? If not, then why not? And then one of the reasons why not was, you know, it's probably a trick designed to lure people, women, to go abroad and force them into prostitution.
And indeed, we actually passed the ad on to the FBI, who then went to investigate whether or not it was a trafficking front. So we see from this that nearly 64% of respondents have, in fact, seen these ads. There is some variation where women older than 18 are more likely to have seen them, college educated more likely to have seen them. But overall, you know, a large number. So then the next question is whether or not you'd answer such an ad. And here we found, I think, in some ways, one of the most reassuring aspects. Fewer than 2% would answer such an advertisement. So then the next question is, okay, if fewer than 2% would answer, why would the others not answer? What is the explanation? We provided a number of possibilities, and we found of those who would not answer, 69% believe the ad was most likely trying to trick women into forced prostitution abroad. So, you know, for all of you out there who worked very hard to raise awareness on this issue, I would say congratulations. There's a large number of people who actually understand what's going on. Anything else to say on that?
No, I mean, but just to point out that we do recognize that that's not the only way in which women are lured into trafficking through ads like this. And so we don't want to create the impression that, you know, we think that there's no problem, that 70% of Russian women recognize these ads to be, you know, attempts to lure women into trafficking, and therefore there's no risk. There's many other mechanisms through which women can be entrapped, right. And so...
Right, and I should say also, this survey was not primarily designed to focus on human trafficking. It was actually primarily focusing on experiences of discrimination and harassment in the workplace and educational institutions. And through an agreement, we added questions on trafficking. And we'll talk more about if, you know, in the ideal world, there'd be more surveys exploring various different kinds of trafficking. We chose to focus on one specific aspect. And indeed, looking at the role of social networks, for example, whether this happens through acquaintances rather than advertisements. So, you know, this is, again, a benchmark survey. So next we looked at, since we found that only 2% would have responded to these ads, but an overwhelming number of women had seen these ads, where are these women hearing about going abroad voluntarily but then being forced to work in prostitution against their will? And here we found that the vast majority are hearing this from television. They're learning about this from television. Now, since major television channels in Russia are controlled by the state, we would say that, you know, here's one example. This seems to be the way in which the government is approaching this issue. They're allowing movies or documentaries, shows about trafficking to go on, and we think that's important. It's a good thing. It should continue. There are other things the government needs to do. We can get into that, but they're not doing. You can see we've asked about radio, films, newspapers, friends and family, internet, and the response categories are much fewer. All right, here we asked, how many people do you personally know who traveled abroad voluntarily and then were forced to work as prostitutes? And we found that nearly, 6%, a little less than 6% of the respondents knew somebody that had gone abroad voluntarily and then were forced to work as prostitutes. We also asked, based on consultation with some of you on how to phrase questions and the things that you wanted to know, did they know any women who worked abroad as prostitutes because they chose to? And here we also found a little less than 4% knew somebody who'd done this. Now here is, in some ways, what I suppose to me was one of the most shocking findings. For respondents 18 and over, so we excluded the 16 to the minors, the 16 and 17-year-olds in the sample, we asked them, through a different process that Ted will describe in a second, have you been tricked into going abroad voluntarily and then forced to work as a prostitute? And we found that in the sample, the smaller sample of 1,744, that we had 16 women who'd been trafficked. And we asked, we were concerned about this finding, we actually asked the Levada Center to go back and double check on this. And we feel, after a lot of quality control, that this number stands. And the number is important because, based on this number, looking at the estimated population size of this cohort, you get a sample-based estimate of the number of women ages 18 to 34 currently living in Russia who are trafficked. And that's the number that NPR picked up on this morning in the show. That's where, and I said it was a little more than 89,000, or I said it was 90,000, but that's what that is. That's the lower bound estimate. Do you want to add anything about the way in which they were responding to this question?
Well, so the design of the survey was face-to-face interview. However, the survey contained a number of questions of a rather sensitive nature, in particular about, this question for one, and then a question about whether the woman had ever exchanged sex for money or gifts. and then some questions about abortions, miscarriages. And in the pretest, a lot of the respondents balked at some of these questions, not surprisingly. And based on the advice of the Levada Center people who have asked, you know, many surveys over the years, including many sensitive questions, they thought the way to handle this would be to have the especially sensitive questions at the end of the survey, and rather than have the interviewer actually give the, ask the respondent questions, the interviewer gave them a form for self-completion and told them that they, that they should complete the form themselves, and then it would be placed in an envelope and sealed so that the respondent, you know, wouldn't have to reveal to the interviewer her answer to these questions. And we think that this worked pretty well in terms of, you know, getting valid responses. We were surprised by the large number of affirmative responses, so we did ask a lot of people to go back and to, you know, particularly verify with all those women whether or not they had taken the survey and whether or not they had completed out the form at the end. And, you know, it wouldn't have been unethical to ask them if they had answered this particular question in a certain way. But they were asked, did you complete the survey? Did you fill out the confidential part at the end and put it in the envelope? And, you know, in every case that we have here, that was indeed verified. They also re-entered all the data to make sure it was double-entered to make sure there were no data entry mistakes. So
again, based on this, the lower bound estimate is 89,758, and the upward bound is 200,061, and the mean is 175,564. By taking the more conservative estimate of approximately 90,000. What we're saying, what I'm saying, is that you've got 90,000 survivors of this who are not receiving any kind of benefits at this moment. And that's, I think, something that the Russian government, perhaps the Obama administration, ought to be thinking about.
Yeah, there really is a lower bound estimate. I mean, so the way this works is you have a point estimate from the sample, you derive what's called a confidence interval around that, which is, you know, taking into account the fact that in any random sample you have sampling error and sampling uncertainty. And so the true population value probably lies, and again, it's not with certainty, but probably lies between those two lower and upper confidence limits, 0.5% and 1.4%. And then we can project those numbers onto the population size to come up with a projected number of actual victims in the population. So actually, our you know, based on the data, the best estimate we have is actually the point estimate, which would be 175,000, and then 90,000 is the lower bound. It could be as many as 261,000. And we'd emphasize that really you need more surveys of this nature to replicate this to before one should start feeling confident in any of these numbers. And that there is a tendency for survey numbers to become, what's the word, reified and take on a life of their own, and that you know, it's important to be cautious when throwing these numbers around, perhaps especially so with respect to sensitive issues and questions like this.
We then wanted to figure out, again, trying to test on this issue of whether or not trafficking is something that, you know, Westerners are mostly concerned about. This is a potential target population. How does this potential target population think about it? So we asked, currently many Russian women go abroad voluntarily and then are forced to work as prostitutes against their will. This happens very rarely to Russian women today, hard to say. And finding in this case was that 58% agreed with the statement, currently many Russians go abroad voluntarily and then are forced to work as prostitutes against their will. Again, more evidence suggesting that this is in fact a problem. 21% responding, this happens very rarely to Russian women today.
These are some say, others say format questions. So the respondent said, some people say that you know, lots of women go abroad, others say that this doesn't really happen very much. Some say that it's a major problem, some say it's a secondary problem. So it sort of gives the respondent a balanced choice to create the impression that there's sort of a controversy, or there's you know, there's certainly not a conventional wisdom that there are different views on this issue. Where is the respondent?
And then we asked, which statement do you agree with most about the seriousness of the problem? The so-called trade in humans is a very serious problem for Russia today. And there we had 78% of respondents agreeing that trade in humans is a very serious problem for Russia today. Again, this is where NPR gets the 80%, I think what they said was 80% of Russian women, and I think what I said was 80% of survey respondents, but only 13% responding that it's a secondary problem. So again, more evidence that they're taking this seriously. All right, let's talk a little bit about policy implications, and you know, when we get through the rest of the findings, we can go back and talk more about this. You know, I think what we can say today is that these young Russian women are aware of the problem and they're concerned about it. And I think it's time that we hear a response from the Russian government and, frankly, society doing more on this. Ted and I have done a lot of work with mainstream human rights organizations in Russia, and they have not done a lot of work on this issue. This has remained the work of, you know, long fighting, long-suffering anti-trafficking networks, and the mainstream human rights organizations have not taken this up. So what would we like to see? Well, I think, you know, we applaud the fact that television is obviously in Russia have been addressing this issue based on survey findings, but we'd like to see the comprehensive anti-trafficking legislation that has been held up in the Duma for 5 years get passed. And given the fact that there is, if the government wants it to happen, then it will happen. We'd like to see it happen. I think support for NGOs would be extremely important. But I think also the need for witness protection and survivor services is really, you know, just absent. This is, you know, just playing around, thinking about what would an advertisement campaign look like using the survey data. We've done some work trying to introduce social marketing into Russia using survey responses of how Russians think about various issues. You know, the messaging that jumped out at me was 8 out of 10 women, young women in Russia, believe human trafficking is a very serious problem. What are you doing to stop it? That was, of course, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. This is President Medvedev, for those of you who are not following Russia every single day. Same message. This is President-elect Barack Obama, and you know, we are expecting that the State Department will continue, and the Obama administration will continue to focus on human trafficking. And we'd like to see in the Russia policy that this becomes an issue. Again, Russia's been Tier 2 watch list for 5 years. There is a recommendation for the transition team that as they move forward on thinking about trafficking and how trafficking is dealt with in the State Department, that they ought to prioritize the Tier 2 watch list countries and develop programs that are tailored to those contexts. We are very insistent that, again, this is a benchmark survey. There are a lot of surveys that we'd like to see done. There's a lot of internal trafficking in Russia. This is a survey that focused on cross-border trafficking. There is enormous amounts of migrant labor in Russia, and forced migrant labor in Russia would be something that we'd be interested in looking at. Attitudes of the police. There were about 5 years ago, I spent a lot of time talking to IOM and USAID about the need for a survey of the police. 5 years ago, we might have been able to do it. I don't know that we could do that today in Russia. But also attitudes of the general population. I mean, I think it would be really important to know what young men think about this, or middle-aged men. One way I think that we hope to see the Obama administration tackle human rights issues generally is that they acknowledge that human rights issues are not something only abroad, but are in the U.S., and that we address this in part through our own struggles with slavery, so that President-elect Obama might have greater purchase in dealing with other countries on this issue if he's talking about what we've gone through. But I think, you know, using these data to send a message to the Russian population would be important. I'd like to see these issues raised with the President and Prime Minister, and not very big, but also targeted assistance. Now, one thing I want to say in closing before we turn to views and experiences about prostitution is, and this came to me really reading a recent paper on this issue, that there is a kind of absent victim in a lot of how Russians deal with violent episodes from the past. And what do I mean by that? That there is, and we've done a lot of survey work on how young people think about the past, about Stalin. There is a kind of absent victim in terms of the Gulag for any of you who followed how the Russians responded to the terrible terrorist attacks in the theater in October 2002 and in the school in September 2004 in Beslan. Again, an absence of the victims. So, you know, what we'd like to see, I think, is a legal approach that really puts victims at the center, a counter-trafficking approach that focuses on victims and survivors. And there are specific cultural challenges to that in Russia that we need to think through. All right, looking at views on prostitution. Again, we came to this not having seen a lot of systematic survey data, that through the 1990s, I'm sure that some of you have heard the study claim that 60% of Russian female high school students would exchange sex for hard currency. We think that this conventional wisdom lives on today. I'm just going to read you a quote that came from a piece in Vyestnik from 2006. The sexualization of Russian culture has both sensationalized and normalized prostitution, causing many women to seek it as an acceptable form of work in the face of economic hardship. So we have a range of conventional wisdoms and myths regarding prostitution, that Russian women buy into the pretty woman or into the devichka image of prostitution, that Russian women see prostitution as viable, even attractive types of work. So how do young Russian women view prostitution? Here, I'm going to turn it over to Ted.
Okay, well, we asked a range of questions, in fact. So to get at this question, this issue of views towards prostitution. So here we have a battery of 9 different statements regarding prostitution in which the respondents were given a Likert scale to indicate whether and how strongly they agreed or disagreed with these questions. And very consistently, a negative attitude emerges. So in terms of prostitution can be an altogether attractive profession. That first column there, the numbers don't show up too well on this graph. So 84% disagree with that statement, either, and most of them fully so. Prostitution is a good way to meet a suitable husband. 76% disagree with that. Prostitutes can help resolve family problems by providing certain services that wives don't want to. And this is one of the quotes that came out of the focus groups, by the way. It's not our own invention. But again, you know, there's disagreement with that question by and large. Prostitution is like any other type of work. 77%. Some types of prostitution are humiliating, others are attractive. So, you know, maybe women have different attitudes towards different types of prostitutes, you know, high class call girls as opposed to streetwalkers. But actually, even that sort of mild statement elicits very little agreement, and 70% disagree. I have different attitudes about different types of prostitutes. So here there's a little bit more of a range in the distribution. So 53% disagree, 28% actually agree with that statement. So there's some sense of perhaps a little ambivalence. But then when asked about the statement, prostitutes are always threatened by violent and abusive treatment, there's overwhelming agreement, 86%. Prostitution inherently degrades women, 87% agree. And prostitutes who use narcotics disgust me. You know, again, something that came out of the focus groups, 87%. So based on these numbers, you can hardly look at this and maintain that prostitution is normalized or legitimized or considered just like any other work on the part of Russian women. Next, we asked women to rate 10 different occupations in terms of their attractiveness, or actually 9 we ended up asking about because of the way that they charge for questions. Actually, you save a lot of money by, you get charged for a battery like this, you get charged for every 3 questions. So we have a lot of batteries of 9 or 6 questions. So another one of those studies is much cited from Moscow in the early 90s found that they did this type of survey with some high school girls, and they found that prostitution came out ranked as the most attractive of all professions. Well, either times have really changed, or that original study was completely invalid, because we find exactly the opposite, that of all the professions we asked about, and they're asked to rank them on a scale of 1 to 10, prostitution came in with an average rating of 1.2. So just about the vast majority of the respondents gave the lowest possible rating, and professions like banker, doctor, TV reporter came out much higher. So, you know, we think that this this myth really is quite a myth, and that it's time to change the discourse about Russian women. They don't want to be prostitutes. They don't think prostitute is a glamorous, normal, everyday profession. We also asked them, have they ever themselves had sex only in order to receive money or gifts? So that's how we phrase it, to sort of distinguish the situation that most we characterize as one of prostitution from more ambiguous types of situations. And the vast majority never have, according to their responses. So there are actually 6% who said in the survey that they have done so. Is that a large number or a small number? I guess it depends on one's perspective, but it's certainly not the massive numbers that one would expect if this notion that Russian women feel good about prostitution or feel it's acceptable, if that were true, one would expect far more than 6%, I think.
Now, again, this survey was conducted in March and April of 2008. I don't know if anybody knows what oil prices were, but they were heading upwards of $145 a barrel. I think yesterday it was $45 a barrel. And despite Prime Minister Putin's upbeat message yesterday, I think we should all be quite sober about the possibility that the financial crisis, the economic crisis, is going to hit Russia, and it's going to hit young women. And so the question is, will Russian women be seeking, going forward, work abroad or moving internally? And are we going to see rates of trafficking and prostitution go up as a result? We need to be thinking about what the Russian government, what we can do to try and prevent that. All right, let's now go to a view of gender-based harassment and discrimination at work.
Okay, so there are many reports according to which sexual harassment of women is widespread in Russia, but we haven't seen very many or any random sample surveys that there are sort of anecdotal evidence, like case studies, interview-based studies, maybe small selective surveys. This was a major theme of our focus groups and a major theme of the research, and rather than asking women, well, have you ever been sexually harassed at work, which of course would generate very questionable results, we asked them about a series of very specific types of experiences that they may have had, and we asked them about their current jobs, or if they were not currently working, their most recent jobs, we asked them about first, and then we asked them about the job they had prior to that job. And then we also asked questions, have you ever, in any other jobs, experienced these types of actions on the part of your bosses? So the first we ascertained whether or not they ever had a male boss in these various jobs and then overall. And of all respondents, there are 1,103 who have at least one job where their boss is or was male.
And are making a gendered assumption, as our Ford Foundation colleagues
reminded
us.
So we're sort of assuming that most harassment comes from male bosses, most harassment of women. Indeed, there may be sexual harassment of women by female bosses, but that's going to have to be the subject of a different study because we're focused on the former here, for better or worse. So the idea here is that, based on our assumption, flawed though it may be, women who don't have a male boss are not really exposed to sexual harassment by a male. And, of course, again, I want to point out that, of course, harassment can occur from the part of coworkers, not necessarily from bosses. It can come in from clients. It can come in all different forms. And, again, within the limited context of a single survey, we felt it was important to focus on the main and perhaps most pernicious form of harassment, and that is when a male boss, a person of authority over a woman, harasses her sexually. And so we asked about three different forms of harassment for each job. One, you know, has your boss ever joked that women are stupid or incompetent? Has the boss ever made flirtatious remarks or gestures that made you feel uncomfortable? And has the boss ever pressured you to have sex, even though you didn't want to, sort of how it was phrased? And so among the women who've ever had a male boss, 31% say that at some point the boss had joked that women are stupid or incompetent. 33% that the boss had made flirtatious remarks and that made them feel uncomfortable, unwanted flirtation. And then 7% had been pressured by the boss to have sex. So these numbers are sort of out there in a vacuum. We don't have any comparisons. You know, we'd like to run this, we haven't looked much into research that's been done in the United States or other countries for comparative purposes to see, you know, are these numbers a lot? You know, it certainly does suggest that there is fairly widespread. If, you know, a third of women are subject to flirtatious, unwanted flirtatious remarks from their boss, 7% are being pressured to have sex. That strikes us as fairly substantial numbers. So a few other questions. Now, we asked these questions about, not about each job, but overall. You know, ever in your working career, if you've had a male boss, have you had problems at work because you refused to have sex with the boss? 3% have had such problems. 0.6% say that they actually have had sex with their boss because they were pressured to. And there are 4% who were asked during a job interview if they would consider having sex with their boss. And this question, actually, a lot of people said, well, you can't put that question. No one is ever going to say that because, you know, it would be illegal. And it, you know, we can't imagine that anybody would ever ask that during a job interview. You know, that, and even if, and usually it's the director of personnel who does a job interview, not the boss. So why would they even ask about it? And we say, oh, well, let's just ask. We'll see. And so 4%, you know, have actually been asked that. And, you know, and this is not, this doesn't come out of the blue. I mean, there have been many reports about the sexualization of the workplace during the 1990s, and you read all the time about job ads asking for, you know, attractive young women to work as a receptionist with a flexible attitude or without complexes and this kind of language. And, you know, it's easy that you can just go on the internet and find ads of this nature in Russia. And so, you know, we have evidence that this is indeed something of a phenomenon. So another way to look at this, and just to put a somewhat different spin, because this actually lets us look at whether or not there's variation in exposure to these experiences by different types of employment situations, is to look at what percentage of the jobs on which women actually reported, the specific jobs, involve each of these respective forms of sexual harassment. And so there were 1,467 specific jobs reported on in which women had a male boss. And then from those, 25% of the jobs overall, there was at least occasional instances where the boss joked that women or made demeaning jokes that were demeaning to women. About the same percentage of jobs on which women reported in which the boss made unwanted flirtatious remarks, and then 4% in which women were pressured to have sex. And so what this suggests is that among the total jobs that you know, a woman has that have a male boss, you can interpret these results as suggesting that 1 in 4 such jobs, the woman will be exposed to unwanted flirtation, jokes demeaning to women, and, you know, substantially fewer, but still 4% of the jobs will women be pressured to have sex. So overall, at least one of these forms of harassment was present in 36% of the jobs that the women have held, and all three forms were present in 3% of the jobs. So with this measure, you know, since we also asked other questions about the job, you know, what was the occupation, what was property form, was it a private sector job or a public sector? There have been some implications that sexual harassment is more widespread in the private sector and private firms. We asked, also, you know, part-time versus full-time, we can see is there variation in experiences for harassment. And we don't actually find much variation. So looking at exposure to the three specific forms we asked about, and then to any of these forms, we find really no statistically significant differences by occupation. And there is one little point, and that is that actually managerial women do say, 39% of jobs where the woman is a manager, do they report unwanted flirtation. And that's almost statistically significant if you just compare the managers to everybody else. It's a type of finding that's sort of borderline significance, and I would say that it merits further research. It could be that in the managerial ranks, for some reason, women who hold these positions and deal obviously with other managers, that maybe they're especially likely to have unwanted flirtation from their supervisors. There are no significant differences by sector, so we reject the claim that harassment is more widespread in the private sector. It appears to be just as common in the public sector because none of those differences are significant. There is one significant effect with respect to education, and that is 10% of the women with less than secondary education report being pressured to have sex by their boss, and that stands out as especially high. So, you know, it could be indeed the case that bosses are more likely to direct their unwanted pressure towards women who are most vulnerable or perhaps youngest. And we also don't find any variation by hours worked. So, our overall conclusion is that there's not much evidence of variation by occupation, sector, or employment, or hours worked, and that there is some evidence of variation by education. The least educated are the most likely to be pressured to have sex by their boss. And I would add also that there is some chance that also managerial women are more likely to experience unwanted flirtations. So when it comes to discrimination, you know, again, we refrain from asking women, have you ever been discriminated against? Because that's a subjective kind of statement, or at least potentially could be read as such. And so we really focused on one particular form of discrimination that, again, has received a lot of attention in the literature on gender and labor market, and that is discrimination against women who become pregnant. And the idea here is that Russian employers may not want to hire women because they're afraid they'll become pregnant and want to take maternity leave.
And here, of course, you also have the perfect storm, where if you have an economic crisis, at the same time you have a demographic crisis, and people are being encouraged to have more babies, but then there's discrimination in the workplace. It could all work out very badly for people actually having more kids.
And we've heard there is plenty of anecdotal evidence in cases where women have discussed either themselves or their acquaintances being fired as a result of a pregnancy. So we got this in a number of ways, and I think probably the best way, the most accurate measure we have comes from questions we ask women about their pregnancy. So each time they're pregnant, we ask them, okay, when you first were pregnant, were you working at the time? If you were working, you know, then what did you do? Did you quit working? Did you continue working and take maternity leave? Did you continue working and not take maternity leave? Were you fired as a result of your pregnancy? And using this measure, 2% of the respondents who had actually gotten pregnant while they were working said they were fired or they quit under pressure from their boss due to the pregnancy. 24% say they know at least one friend, acquaintance, or family member who lost a job due to pregnancy. So that's a substantially higher number that suggests it's a little bit more widespread than the 2% response indicates. 4% of those who interviewed for a job were asked to sign a statement promising they would not get pregnant. And 60% were asked if they have kids during a job interview, which is often interpreted as a no-no with respect to discrimination issues. So, I mean, that's those are the numbers we have on discrimination, and you could look at that 2% number and say, oh, well, you know, only 2% of women are getting fired because they're pregnant. What's the big deal? But you have to remember that the 2% happens after an extensive series of measures that are designed to never hire women who are pregnant in the first place. So perhaps the job interview data and the data on how many people women know are more telling. Nonetheless, you know, those figures, they suggest it is a phenomenon, but again, you know, this is an initial benchmark survey, and we will have to compare this to other data from other settings, from late other time periods in Russia, to assess, you know, whether these numbers represent a high level of discrimination, a low level of discrimination. Clearly there is some discrimination.
Okay, now we're going to shift into a discussion about how women view harassment, and this discussion will reveal how they think about different norms surrounding gender.
Attitudes towards harassment vary in different places. So one study in particular, which I thought was a particularly good one, it interviewed legal professionals in France and the United States and showed that there are very different conceptions of harassment there. And one of the mechanisms they used is they just read scenarios to these legal professionals in the two countries and said, well, according to French law, is that harassment? According to American law, they found very different. And so we used this basic approach in the survey, and in the focus groups, we actually found some video clips with the help of the students from EUSP we were working with, and we showed them. They provoked some very interesting reactions. But in the survey, we couldn't show a video clip. It would be too hard to manage that technically. But we did have scenarios such as this one. And sort of the design of this is to get the question of, to get at the issue of whether or not Russian women perceive this type of behavior on the part of their male bosses as being unacceptable, inappropriate, or maybe they find that this is just normal, this is just the way men are, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so it's also related to this idea of, you know, Russian women having a different attitude towards issues involving sex and sexuality. With respect to prostitution, I think we've shot that down. With respect to harassment, you know, we want to get that as well. So this was a scenario where said your girlfriend complains that her boss acts in too familiar a manner toward her, compliments her figure, asks if she would cheat on her husband, proposes meeting outside of work, pinches her rear. Right? She asks him to stop, but he continues to behave this way. So what do you think about this boss's behavior? Which of the following statements do you agree with most? That there's nothing wrong with it, it's normal for men to flirt like that. And 13% of the respondents agreed with that. Then 43% said the behavior is unacceptable and must stop, but the boss should not be punished if he stops. So that's 43%, you know, do recognize this as harassment is unacceptable, but they don't believe that there should be consequences for the boss if he just stops the behavior. And then 35% agree that the behavior is unacceptable, it must stop, and that upper management should somehow punish the boss. So there should be consequences that you know, the boss shouldn't be allowed to get away with this. And another 9% says it's hard to say. So you could look at this and say, well, you know, 80% just about find this behavior unacceptable and think it should stop. And so it doesn't, it's far from the case that Russian women think, oh, you know, boys will be boys, you know, it's just a normal kind of situation. But it's also interesting, we think that you know, there's really only a third who actually think there should be consequences, that the boss should be punished. So there is a suggestion that while this is not normal, acceptable behavior, that it is tolerable behavior, and that if it's just brought to an end, then people can just go about their business. Another interesting question is, how do women deal with harassment in the workplace? And so we followed up this last question with a question. So what would you advise your friend to do in this situation? And choose all the following that apply. And the modal response here is actually that you would tell your friend to stop provoking the boss with her own behavior and style of dress. And so there is a sort of blame the victim type of mentality evident here, that you know, women, those 26% who answered thus, they would assume that it's actually the woman who's provoking the boss to act in this inappropriate manner. 24% advocate or would suggest trying to diffuse the situation with humor, trying to avoid conflict, just sort of work your way around it. 22% said that you just quit the job. So the top three responses are all sort of problematic in the sense that they're either blaming the victim herself or saying that, you know, she should be the one to suffer, she should be the one to quit her job, or she should just try to deal with it somehow and not really take any other action. So 17% then advocated telling upper management about the situation, and 14% advocated getting help from a lawyer. So those are pretty low numbers. It suggests that there's very little perception that you know, upper management would support a woman who's being harassed at the workplace, and very little sense that there's a legal system or legal advice that could help her have her rights protected. And interestingly enough, there's actually not a lot. So in the focus groups, a number of the women, in fact, some of the women recounted their own experiences, and there were two who said that they were having, you know, experiences where they were being made to feel uncomfortable, and they brought their boyfriend or their husband into work with them one day, and that was enough to make it stop. But only 11% actually said that that was advice that they would give to their friends, and only 3% say she should actually go meet her boss because it might get her a promotion. So
I want to say one comment about the focus groups. We've done, I don't know, maybe almost 24 focus groups on a variety of issues over 7 years. And this series of focus groups, participants were more engaged on these topics than anything else we've looked at: the war in Chechnya, army abuse, police abuse, views on democracy versus authoritarianism, which they pretty much fall asleep at, views on Stalin. But this was, you know, really, I mean, aktualna for the, you know, this is real for these women. And it was very interesting. I think they also, they liked being asked these questions. They liked having the chance to talk about it.
It was problematic in a few of them because they would all talk at the same time. And so it was very hard to, you know, to hear what they were saying because they were all talking at once, and the transcript, you know, didn't really come out in large parts of it. All right, so finally, and we want to open up the floor, so we'll go through this a little quick. We have a bunch of questions dealing with traditional gender norms with respect to career, with respect to work, family issues. And so we want to just briefly focus on three. So in Russia, you know, we find some evidence that I'll show that there persists a view of the appropriateness of certain occupations for men or for women. We find a very strong commitment to the idea that having a child is absolutely essential to a woman's happiness, that you know, a woman isn't a real woman unless she has a child, unless she gives birth and raises a child, to put it starkly. And that a woman's primary role is to care for the family, and that although it's fine for women to work, that their careers really are and should be secondary. And so these ideas came up, you know, our focus groups, and we have questions which get into it too. So we asked, again, about 9 occupations. And we asked for each one, you know, do you think men are more suited for this occupation, that women are more suited for this occupation, and that men and women are equally suited? And so for high school teacher, the modal response is that they're equally suited. And same for journalists, you know, those big gray bars in the middle are those who say they're equally suited. When it comes to flight attendant, they actually think women are more suited, or better, more appropriate for that job. Doctor, actually, you know, not surprisingly, given the feminization of the occupation in Russia, they think men and women are equally suited. When it comes to CEO of a large firm, then we start to see, you know, nearly 50%, 49% say that men are more suited to be executives in large firms. Oldest governor, 62% say that men are more suited for that. Police officer, 78% say men are more suited. Physicist, interestingly enough, 83%, and then military officer, overwhelmingly 90%. So there are still a sort of a normative sex typing of occupations on the part of Russian women.
Before we move on, I mean, you can see obviously that if you're concerned about governance and rule of law, that the fact that these women think that women are less suited is a problem, and it might be something to be addressed.
So next we wanted to know sort of what do women think is crucial to their happiness or to women's happiness. So we said for each of these attributes, you know, is it not at all important, not very important, somewhat, very, or extremely important for a woman to be happy in life? And 86%, you know, think it's either extremely or very important to have kids, close friends, 72%. Good education, you know, 67%. A successful husband, interestingly enough, doesn't rank quite as high as some of the others, so that's 58%. And in fact, one of the themes that comes up in a lot of the questions we have is that the norm of childbearing and childrearing is still very crucial, very central to women's identity, but the devotion to a husband or commitment to the idea of marriage seems to be diminishing. Successful career is down there pretty low, below all the others. So 60%, roughly speaking, slightly less, say that that's important, very important, or extremely important. And we were surprised by this. We thought attractive appearance would come out more strongly, but it doesn't. So that's the least important of all. So then we asked, of all these things, what is the most important of all for a woman to be happy in life? And here, overwhelmingly, it's kids, followed by husband, and then career only comes in third place with 11% saying it's the most important of all. Then we have some specific questions, and I'll just go through these quickly. So a woman needs to have kids in order to be a true woman, so 63% agree with that statement. A woman needs to have a career in order to be complete. Only 30% agree with that, and there's more who disagree. So 45% disagree that a woman needs to have a career to be complete. It's okay for a woman to have a job, but her family should be her priority. Overwhelming agreement, 84% say agree with that. A woman can be happy without a husband, all right? So again, fairly even distribution, evidence at 50%, of Russian women in this age group think a woman can be happy without a husband. It's acceptable for a woman to be devoted to career even if she has a family. Okay, some disagreement, a fairly broad range. And then this last statement, this is a...
It should read, a female scholar is neither a female nor a scholar.
Right, and so this is a joke that we've heard Russian male academics make from time to time, and the women do not tend to agree with this. Finally, and then we'll move to the conclusion, a bunch of more questions about attitudes toward children and marriage, and this, what comes through here is the point I just made, that I think marriage is less of a strong norm these days than childbearing. So marriage ties one down and limits one's personal freedom. 46% agree with that. Women should not give birth outside of marriage. There's actually substantial disagreement with that, which is quite interesting. It suggests it's become more normatively acceptable among Russian women to have children outside of marriage. It's every woman's patriotic duty to have children for the good of Russia. So, of course, that's a lot of the rhetoric, or the implications of the rhetoric coming out of the Russian government. And there's not a lot of traction for that message among women. Only 30% agree with that statement. Current economic conditions are favorable for having children if a woman wants to. All right, so there's more disagreement than agreement. 42% disagree. A woman should divorce her husband if the marriage is unhappy, even if they have children. So here, 60% agree with that statement. There's more signs that marriage is less important than children. It's hard to find a good husband in Russia today. A theme that came out in the focus groups, and 70% of the women agree.
So just in closing, and then we'll open it up for discussion. Again, we have a lot of data on family formation and whether or not Russian women want to have babies and the effect of Putin's maternity capital paying women to have second children. But just to say that, again, I think looking at this, we find more evidence that victims' rights are not paramount. We need to figure out how to get more women into police or to change the stigma around certain professions. And I think particularly, perhaps, governance positions. But thank you for your patience. And let's open it up for Q&A. We can flip back to whatever data you want to look at. And do use the microphones and state who you are. So are there any questions or comments?
Hi, my name is Andrea.
You need to push the...
My name is Andrea Mazzarino, and I'm an anthropology graduate student. First of all, thank you for this. And I had a comment and a question. I do anthropological research right now on women in managerial positions in Russia. And one thing that I found is that many are very resentful towards human rights and feminist discourses on trafficking because they find it to be condescending to take away their agency. Even though I find that they travel very often for business, and there have been some pretty serious incidences when they have been forced to have sex by people who they encounter in working situations abroad. So I wanted to ask you if you had found any connections between social class and attitudes towards trafficking, because this could shed light on some of the ways that women are reporting their experiences with trafficking, and also how attitudes might influence people's vulnerability.
I'm going to let Ted speak in a second. I'll say that this issue of condescension and how they view human rights discourse, I think it's very important that the human rights activists in Russia start thinking about this. I will say there's a lot of conversation in the focus groups about American women. We decided for a variety of reasons not to put any of those questions on the survey. But American women, and you can't generalize from focus groups, but American women are the rights more. America is, you do anything and there are lawsuits in the United States. American women will leave the house without makeup, and this is a terrible thing. American women being very careerist. And, American women as a kind of the other, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah, we haven't looked at whether or not perceptions of the issue vary by various factors, and we certainly should do that based on your comments. I mean, maybe it is something that different parts of the population perceive in different terms. We have looked at the issue of vulnerability and whether or not that varies, and we actually didn't find a lot of very strong, consistent results. So it sort of depends on how you measure vulnerability. Like if you measure vulnerability in terms of saying that you would consider responding to that job ad, for example, well, you don't find any variables have any significant effect, which is not surprising since only 2% of the women say they would respond. But if you define it sort of more broadly and say, well, a woman is, we can construe her as vulnerable if she doesn't identify that type of ad as a trick to deceive women to going abroad so they can be forced into prostitution, well, we don't find much evidence. There is some evidence that the least educated women are more likely not to see it as a trick, so they're perhaps more vulnerable based on that question. Interestingly enough, the least vulnerable of all in terms of places of residence, based on that conception, would be those living in small villages. They're the most likely to say that this is a trick, which is the opposite of sort of what one would expect. So we do find consistent evidence that those who say that they've seen an anti-trafficking public service announcement, they are significantly more likely to identify that ad as a risk, and also say that they've heard about the issue of trafficking. So another way to define vulnerability is, have you even heard of this issue? Or is it something you've never even heard of at all? And by that criteria, again, rural women are more likely to have heard of trafficking than women in other cities, although women in Moscow are actually the most likely of all. And then college-educated women are also more likely to have heard of that. So, it's a good point. It might be that certain occupations, and I'd be interested in what you think about this sort of provisional finding that managerial women are more likely to have experienced unwanted flirtatious remarks. Maybe there's something about having to work in those circles that makes women especially willing to put up with these remarks, or I don't know what's going on there. So if you have any insights to that, it'd be interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting because there might be specific vulnerabilities.
Specific vulnerabilities related to profession, even though women are likely to define their experiences differently from mm-hmm. women who are responding to these ads
right.
for secretarial work abroad. But thank you.
Hi, my name is Denise Brennan. I'm a professor of anthropology at Georgetown University. And I'm writing a book on life after trafficking to the United States. And I'm really intrigued by the figure of 89,000 to 100 and something of folks that actually identify as having experienced forced labor. And there are a lot of questions that come out of that from what Sarah raised, that, okay, these are people who are not receiving services. But also to go into more depth, the idea of victimhood with this historical experience with the gulag and the silences that surround victimhood, that is tremendously troubling. And I was hoping you could tease that out a little more. I also wanted to just raise the question of also what has been a very effective tool in terms of preventing future migrants who really have no social networks and don't know what they're getting into, which is just a perfect recipe for them ending up in a bad situation, has been through peer educators. So I've worked for 10 years in the Dominican Republic with voluntary adult sex workers, many of whom were very effective peer educators, on some of whom had gone abroad as sex workers and had successful experiences. But having, in other words, people who have traveled abroad and had either successful or negative experiences become much more effective than TV shows. Actually, my experience in the Dominican Republic is that TV was laughed at. These representations were so explosively sensationalistic that sort of, if you will, rough and tumble women who have seen the world a bit, they just think these passive victims portrayed on you know, the classic kind of docudrama are just laughable, and it actually emboldens them to pursue smuggling opportunities. So I see this 90,000 as a potential, I mean, not just that they need to get services, but as this potential story, you know, this potential narrative of what to look out for, these potential mentors. And also that ties in with, Sarah, your point, which is so well taken, and it is, has a lot of resonance in the United States, and that trafficking cannot just be prevented by anti-trafficking organizations, that there has to be a wide range of community-based organizations that work on a range of issues brought in. And it seems that some of these 90,000 women could emerge as very vocal feminist community advocates on domestic violence, on harassment in the workplace, and that through that, you then have this sort of cadre of advocates on trafficking. Thanks. It's a wonderful study, really impressive.
Thank you. I mean, I think the trick will be finding these people and figuring out ways of finding these people, number one. Number two, the idea that they would then be vocal advocates, I think, is a big question. I mean, they may be themselves so traumatized, but there may be, you know, a handful of, maybe out of that cohort that you do get some kind of movement. There's certainly, to the best of my knowledge, and maybe there are other people in the room, I don't know of people who are working to bring these people together. I think we should recognize that obviously the scale for Russia of the victimhood from the Gulag and the terror under Stalin is—it's sort of hard for Americans to realize the numbers that we're talking about in that case. People debate, what is it, 10 million? Is it 40 million? Is it 60 million? I mean, it's in surveys that we've done of young Russians, 18% of these people have some report having some relative that was repressed in the terror. So. You know, and those are people who may have either perished or lived in exile. Given that enormity, given the fact that there are so many people whose lives were touched by this, even knowing about it doesn't seem to translate into any kind of action. I mean, so in that case, you have majorities of young people actually agreeing with Putin that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century, and that majorities think Stalin did more good than bad. There's an extremely interesting book by Catherine Meridale that looks at how Russians think about death and dying, and sort of very deep cultural explanations of how people relate to this. So, I mean, I think, you know, this whole victimhood issue is just something that's, you start seeing it in a lot of different contexts. How you address it and change it is at this point, I don't know.
I would add, with respect to trafficking, that actually the trafficking victims in Russia, the news is actually quite bad, that if anything, the movement's been the other direction, that groups like the Angel Coalition and others that were funded by international donors and trying to establish victim services had their foreign funding cut, and so now they're struggling to provide any services at all, relying entirely on volunteer, and the Russian government hasn't stepped up to provide any support that we know. So, you know, we think that, you know, indeed, that there needs to be much more emphasis on helping victims. There are also, of course, implications of the victim's willingness to cooperate with law enforcement officials and their ability to actually successfully investigate and prosecute trafficking cases. So there's actually a pragmatic, I mean, law enforcement, if all they care about is getting the trafficking criminals and getting convictions, even from that purely pragmatic motivation, you would think that they would try to implement more effective victim protection and victim services, because that would make victims more willing in principle to cooperate with the investigators if they didn't have to fear for reprisals on the part of the traffickers themselves. And yet, we don't see any sign that there's a movement in this direction, unfortunately.
I'll say, you know, you're looking at a country where the leadership has actually an enormous role to play in shaping attitudes on a variety of issues. You know, if Putin or even Medvedev made comments about this, they could send very strong signals. So it's not really just a casual comment to say that we'd like to see President-elect Obama bring this up, that in the Russian context, actually having the voice of the Prime Minister or the President addressing this is going to send ripple effects through law enforcement throughout Russia. And the silence equally has an effect.
What about this idea about cross collaborations and coalitions across issues that affect women, like DV advocates?
Well, I mean, in the Russian context, there's been, my understanding, and there may be others in the room who have a better sense of this, there's been actually a lot of pressure where at the donor side, their choices between funding either trafficking or domestic violence, which has caused, you know, you are a nonprofit and you're looking for funding, and the people who should be your natural allies working on violence against women are actually your competitors for funding, and it undercuts the ability for these organizations to work together. So it hasn't been an especially happy story today.
First of all, thank you very much for this very interesting talk. My name is Kellen Baker, and I'm a graduate student of public health at George Washington. And I was just wondering if you had any insights into any intersections between xenophobia in Russia and the way people look at trafficking and women taking opportunities to work abroad. I worked for several years in Moscow in LGBT healthcare advocacy, and we've had a lot of problems with that discourse, as was mentioned earlier, around human rights, and in my specific context, LGBT rights, being something Western and therefore foreign and therefore not applicable to a Russian setting. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, with the 12% of women who said that they would never accept a job offer abroad, if sort of women's perceptions of women who are willing to leave Russia to look for opportunities that may not exist there, if that has an effect on victim identification and whether we can access whatever services there are, or even just attitudes towards perhaps lawmakers putting that kind of legislation in practice.
I think we probably have more insight into views on xenophobia actually from other surveys we've done and specific views on different kinds of populations. And I think it's going to be very relevant for future surveys on forced migration. There is a lot of antipathy in Russia in the surveys to people from the Caucasus. In a survey we did in 2007, we found the number one enemy that young Russians felt were Georgians. And of course, this was a precursor to what we saw happen, I think, this summer. So you know, the fear is that the antipathy towards these populations that are the migrant labor populations is that it contributes to an atmosphere of human rights abuse.
Yeah, I think the possibility you raise that, you know, maybe some people in Russia think of these women as saying, well, they get what they deserve, they wanted to go abroad anyway, so... The answer is, I don't know from our data, you know, we didn't really hear that type of sentiment expressed spontaneously in the qualitative part of the research. It doesn't sound impossible to me that, you know, some people might have that particular attitude or might think that these aren't really victims because they want to move abroad. We'd have to really include that on a question like that on a survey to see if that really is part of what's going on.
Before we go, I think you have a question. I want to say that given the fact that most of the funding on this issue does come from foreign sources, the kind of anti-Western campaign, and specifically anti-Western campaign on support for non-governmental organizations that has come right from the Kremlin, has been, and it's come from the Kremlin and security services, frankly, since July 1999, when Vladimir Putin gave an interview in a Russian newspaper saying the problem with the environmental movement is that most of those environmental groups are in the employ of foreign intelligence agencies, and that all the environmental groups were investigated by the domestic inheritor of KGB, the FSB. That kind of campaign, it just makes organizations more wary of taking foreign funding.
Just a follow-up question. Very good. Do you have any sense that those sorts of attitudes towards migrants are part of what's holding up the legislation in the Duma, or what is behind that?
I don't have any specific insight. I suspect what happened was some of the key actors who were working on the legislation, the political party they worked for, which was a liberal political party, was dissolved. I mean, it was essentially, as part of the general shrinking of political space in Russia, it was a casualty of that. And so some of the likely advocates, the people who would be advancing the legislation, are no longer in a position to do that. But again, you know, the government has control over the parliament, so if the government wanted to see this happen, it would happen.
Frank Kendall, I'm on the board of the Tawri Justice Center, which does immigrant women and girls fleeing violence here in the United States. We do asylum cases, violence against women act cases, and trafficking visas as well. And we work on cases and on policy matters. We work on international marriage book grant. My question may be more appropriate for Denise, actually, over there than this for Sarah Ted, but what you described is a fairly massive operation in terms of the numbers that you draw. So I'm curious about the scale of this business and how it's organized. And given the numbers of women that you believe are in Russia who have been victims and then have come back to Russia, what are the numbers like, if you have any estimates for how many women are either here in the United States or in other countries and where they are? So either of you can address that.
The survey doesn't provide a window on that. I will say, I think it was the UN Office of Drugs and Crime, UNODC, a couple of years ago, came out with an estimate that Russian women, or although I think it was Russian-speaking women, which would involve the entire space of the former Soviet Union, were the largest population that was seen overseas in trafficking cases. I think UNODC and a lot of organizations are not in a position to be able to distinguish, is it a Russian Federation citizen, is it a Ukrainian citizen, is it a citizen from Kazakhstan? But you know, I think the reality is we see in the traffic patterns from Russia to Western Europe, to the Far East. A lot of you know I've done work on trafficking in and around peacekeeping and military deployments, and we saw a large number of Russian-speaking women from the Far East going to Korea. So, Denise, do you want to add anything? Do you have any? mean, I think...
I see folks on staff here from all over the world.
I meet people once they're here. I'm an anthropologist. I'm very much on the ground. I will say this much. I am excruciatingly skeptical of the numbers circulating about the global, you know, estimates on the number of people trafficked. And I think that it requires really careful reading between the lines and great historical context, like what these fine scholars are providing. Really, really detailed historical understandings of migration patterns and gender norms, violence inside homes. Anecdotally, it seems that there has been a lot of sort of boyfriend pimping, a lot of stuff that happens out of Russia that you just don't see in other contexts. So I think for especially younger people coming to this issue in the room, you know, don't believe everything you read, and you know, find studies that may not even be on trafficking, but actually get at the conditions, not just for women, but marginalized people in X or Y country that you're trying to analyze, why someone would seek to be smuggled or seek to out-migrate, and then what could possibly go wrong in that region.
Follow up, if you find the roughly 1% number reasonably credible, the 1% number roughly of women that you interviewed who had been trafficked, basically.
It sounds like self-reporting in this context of silence is probably low, right? I mean, the number's probably higher. And, you know, I've met people in Washington from Russia. And it's, I mean, they end up having had a lifetime of, literally a lifetime of male abuse towards them. Truly, you know, some of the worst stories I've heard. But I don't like to trade in those individual stories apart. I think it's much more important to look at, you know, widespread sexual discrimination in the workplace. And you begin to then to think, you begin to be able to assess a woman's calculus as to why she'll answer an ad.
That was in part, we were interested in the pushback term. It's hard to get at it precisely, but it needs to have some kind of context. So, any other questions? Laura, can you come up to it?
Sarah, thank you. I remember when this was a glimmer in your eye, about two and a half years ago, and so thank you for this just so important work, and I wish we could do studies like this in every country. This kind of survey would allow us the numbers that we have been lacking at the State Department. I work with the State Department in the Human Trafficking Office, and I hope that you'll be able to do a part two, and perhaps divide your studies and go more into some of the specifics on human trafficking. Did you ask questions like in that 1%, which is a huge number in Russia, it's a huge number of people. Where were they trafficked to, and did you have time to say, if somebody answers yes to such a question, then to ask a series of questions underneath that?
Yeah, in fact, what you should be thinking about is, you know, let's be optimistic for a moment and think that there will be more funding to do surveys like this. What are the questions that need to be asked? I mean, it's one thing to be, we're very fortunate to be able to have done the focus groups, but we rely on experts who are working in the field. So, you know, what would you like to know? I mean, assuming that we're able to do something going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little tricky because so we're talking literally in a survey of this size of 2,000 women, you're talking about 16 respondents. So even if we were, you know, we'd have to massively increase the sampling size, or we'd have to pursue an alternative sampling strategy. I mean, if we really want to do a study on trafficking, then we, you know, clearly it would traffic victims. It would be possible. It would be difficult. You'd have to oversample victims, and so we'd have to probably work through NGOs to actually identify them. So you use a general representative sample to estimate how common these experiences are. Now, I certainly think it would have been helpful for us to ask at least one or two follow-up questions for these women, just to of those women who did answer yes, and we did not do so, and we certainly could. But I guess the point I want to make is that these surveys are of this nature are useful for identifying, sort of how widespread the phenomenon is. And it's certainly an excellent point to make that this is a very low estimate, because this is an estimate of the percentage of women who have been trafficked from Russia and returned to Russia. And if 1% of women in this age group fall into that category, who knows? I mean, maybe another 2 or 3% are actually still abroad,
This is absolutely correct. Knowing Russian community, I can say you're absolutely true. You're
absolutely correct. In trying to figure out how to incentivize the government to respond to this, again, I think, that this is a population that is central to childbirth. And the fact that you have this population in this situation, I mean, frankly, the Russian government should be concerned about both male and female populations of this age and making sure that they're, healthy and able to have children should they choose to want to.
So, in other words, so if we want to know, where are they being trafficked to? What are the conditions in which they're being trafficked? Why? How are they able to escape? What are their experiences after they've been returned? We would have to do, a more focused victim survey, because you can't make any conclusions on the basis of such a small number of respondents that you would get from a random sample survey.
But, I think we did not believe that we would actually have anybody in the survey who was trafficked, and so that was striking.
Curious, does Russia do its own sort of uniform crime? Do they do samples like that, like we do, like our FBI does, and then the accompanying question, I can't remember the name of it, but the national survey that's done that asks questions about rape and other. Does Russia do anything like that for its own citizens?
I don't know if they do surveys. I mean, I know that they keep track of the number of cases that are filed under different categories. There's a grad student in political science at Madison who I work with, Simon. She's actually writing her dissertation on different law enforcement approaches to trafficking comparing Russia and the U.S. And so I'll ask her where she gets to. She does have some NVD data on the number of cases that have actually been filed and prosecuted, and those have tended to increase. I think there were 500 cases in 2007, up from about 250 the year before.
My sense from that work is it's extremely, it's very complicated. You might have a case that's opened, but that doesn't mean that it goes on to prosecution, that there's several different layers. I mean, part of the problem, it seems, that the way in which law enforcement is structured to investigate and prosecute is extremely burdensome. And that's something that probably ought to be addressed and looked at. So. Any other thoughts or questions? Well, let me thank you very much for coming. And, we welcome any additional comments, just send us emails. We hope to do more with the survey findings, and see you next time. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much.